It's very lovely to be here at this center. The last time I visited was, I think, just after the property had been acquired and everything was very, very new, and people were just beginning to sort through ideas of how to use the space and what improvements to make. So it's lovely just to come back and see how well everyone has settled in and how alive everything here is. So this evening I asked Gil if there are any particular themes that might be interesting or useful, and to my amazement he said, well, there was this talk that you gave about 11 years ago at Santa Sabina. That was a really great talk. And I thought, what? Personally, I could hardly even remember visiting Santa Sabina, let alone what I talked about. But anyway, he remembered it. And so it was a talk about loving kindness. And then also, completely independently, just before the evening began, then our friend here, whose name, Cheryl, asked if we were going to do any chanting. And she said, oh, last time, you know, you were down here, you did this chanting of the Metta Sutta, that would be so great if you could do that. So I thought, okay, well, there seems to be a theme in the air. So I thought that we could just begin with chanting the Metta Sutta in English, and then I'll carry on from there. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Well, the we can tell from these words that the Buddha extolled the virtues of loving kindness very highly, and in many, many instances in his teachings, he praised this metta, loving kindness, as one of the Brahma Viharas, the sublime abidings, the divine mind states. And also spoke of the kind of expansive, bright, and very, very wholesome quality of these. In other verses about this, he uses the phrase abundant, exalted, immeasurable. And also how in accounts of his own previous lives, he said on one occasion he spent many, many thousands of eons in the Brahma worlds, simply on the basis of having practiced loving kindness as a yogi for 7 years in a continuous way, and that was a cause for this enormous, positive response. So there's a tremendous promotion of metta, loving kindness, and the other Brahma Viharas. And a kind of holding of them as these are our emotional nature purified, so that when the mind is liberated, then this is how the emotions operate, through loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, serenity. So these are very powerful and beautiful qualities of the heart. And so when we translate metta into English, then we use the word loving kindness. But the word love in English is a loaded term. To say the Greeks have a word for it. There are many different attributes to it. And so that also when you see translations of the Buddha's teaching into English, say one of the categorical definitions of the causes of suffering, in the first discourse the Buddha gave, the turning of the wheel of Dhamma, the teaching on the middle way and the Four Noble Truths, when he's describing the causes of suffering and the nature of suffering itself, he said this association with the unloved, with the dislike to suffering, separation from the loved, from the liked is suffering. So, how can this be related? If loving kindness is abundant, exalted, immeasurable, and has all these positive qualities, how can it be that then separation from the loved is a cause for suffering? We need to, or it's helpful, it can be helpful to reflect upon these different ways that we love things, the different ways that the heart holds things. And so I thought it might be useful to reflect upon that a little bit this evening. It's a subject that also came up a few days ago at the monastery, so it's kind of also fresh in my mind. When on one occasion, again in the scriptures, where Visakha, who was one of the Buddha's great lay disciples, came to the Buddha in a state of distress. She was had just come from the funeral of her granddaughter, and part of the funeral ceremonies was a ritual bathing. So she arrived at the monastery with wet hair and wet clothing. And the Buddha said to Visakha, how is it that you come to the monastery in the middle of the day and your hair and your clothes are wet? And she said, I just came from the funeral of my granddaughter, and I was so upset and unhappy that I came and wanted to see you and see if you had any advice. Well, Visakha was the great mother figure of the Buddhist scriptures. Not only was she an incredibly generous lay donor and supporter of the monastic communities, but she was, according to legend again, you can take this with as many pinches of salt as you like. She was reputed to have 20 children, 10 daughters, 10 sons, and each of those children had 20 children. So within the space of her own life, she had 400 grandchildren. This is mythology, so, you know, it's okay. I can deal with it. So anyway, even though she had 400 grandchildren, she was extremely upset that this little girl had died. And so the Buddha then asked her, "Well, Visakha, would you like to have as many children and grandchildren as there are people in the whole city of Savatthi?" And she said, "Well, certainly, of course, I would. I love my children and my grandchildren. They're a source of great happiness for me. I'd love to have as many children as there are in the city." And then, of course, the Buddha had sort of been dangling the bait and said, "Well, if that was the case, a day does not pass in the city of Savatthi when somebody when at least 10 people die. And if not 10 people, 9. If not 9 people, 8. 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. At least one person dies every day in Savatthi. So, Visakha, would a day pass without your hair and your clothing being wet from having attended the funeral of one of your children or grandchildren?" Now, Visakha was a stream enterer and pretty smart. So she quickly got the point and said, "Enough of having so many children and grandchildren." But I see the point. And the Buddha said, "Yes, this is because this is the way it is that the kind of possessive love that we have for others. This is the cause of suffering. When we have those that are dear to us, and the Pali word is piya, and so in that definition of separation from the loved being suffering, that is piyehi vipayogo dukho." And so that Pali word piya is, that's what's used in that term. It's not those for whom, separation from those for whom we have metta, right? It's this other quality, piya. But we would use, in English, we'd use the word love for both. So what I'm aiming to do is sort of tease these apart a little bit to point to different kinds of definition. So the Buddha said, when we have this kind of possessive love, a love based on self and other, and a sense of ownership, or a sense of clinging involved, then necessarily that's going to produce suffering. And he said, if you have 100 dear ones, you have 100 pains. You have 90 dear ones, 90 pains. 80, 70, 60, 50, 40. He's very thorough. The master was an extraordinarily thorough person, so. 30, 20, 10, 10 dear ones, 10 pains, 9 dear ones, 9 pains, 5, 4, 3, 2. If you have one dear one, you have one pain, no dear ones, you have no pains. QED. So you might think, but. Because certainly we do experience a lot of joy and delight in the company of those that are close to us, who are dear to us. But what the Buddha's point is, the Buddha's not trying to be a sourpuss or just being kind of negative and a kind of dried up, a sort of celibate monastic kind of grump. Bah, humbug, yeah, love, pah. I spit on your affection. It's not that kind of caustic nihilism, but more a pointing to the physics of it. If we hold each other in that way, and it's not just parent to child or in a relationship with a spouse or a partner, or it's also to spiritual teachers. If your teacher, Gil, being the great sort of spiritual resource of this center, that if you cling to the teacher and your sort of beloved spiritual mentors in that way, in a possessive self and other kind of way, then there is pain in that intrinsically. That's the physics of it. If we hold each other in that way, then even if it's not the pain isn't present right there, there's the undercurrent of fear of loss. Maybe Gil is gone to Hawaii, never to return. He told me he was just going to go and put the kids to bed. Maybe there was this something else happening that says, I'm out of here. Cheerio. Or maybe Paraguay. Or Uzbekistan. Or Tierra del Fuego. You know. Who knows? Svalbard is very nice. I've been there before. Spitsberg, an island off in the Arctic. You know, he's got this Norwegian background. You know. Maybe we'll never see him again, our dear friend. So whether the love is for a spouse or for a child or for a sibling or for a teacher or whatever it might be, we find that if there's this possessive quality, if it's based on self-view, on a strong sense of me and a strong sense of you, then intrinsically in that there is suffering. And the Buddha's, when Buddhist teachings are always offered for reflection, they're not a sort of categorical statements or sort of diktats. You know, it's just, this is what he put out. So look and see for ourselves. You know, is this the fact? How does it work? So on the one hand, metta is highly extolled. Metta, loving kindness, compassion, these are held up, vaunted as wonderful, amazing, beautiful, supportive qualities conducive to liberation, to be developed extensively and completely. And even in that sutta, the Buddha says, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, and perhaps he's using that because the love of a mother for her child is, you know, the kind of archetypal a strength of commitment and a bond. But as we all know, that the bond is painful. You know, when how many of you had children who've left the nest? How did that feel? Like, I remember one time when I'd gone off to university and I rang home and I said, and I talked to my mother and she said, oh, you're still alive. I said, what? She said, well, it's been about 3 months since you called. I said, oh, really? Oh, sorry. And even though she was being sort of facetious, there was this kind of, there was a relief that I was called, that I was still alive. So there are different ways that we relate, and what we find is that when we relate through an absence of self-view, when we relate through the qualities of metta and karuna, loving kindness, compassion, and that's not based on a possessiveness or a strong, you know, concrete sense of me here and you there, then that quality of love is liberating. It supports freedom. It's not a love that is sort of me being close to you because you complete me, or me being close so I can complete you, and that we're in a way relating to each other as that which provides what we feel as the missing piece. If any of you are familiar with Shel Silverstein's wonderful little book, The Missing Piece. Because no matter how hard we try, as long as there's a me and a you, and those are seen to be solid, fixed entities, then inevitably there is separation. You can't get close enough. And the harder that I try to get close to you, the very intensity of effort makes the sense of separation more and more intense. And so it can be very frustrating, painful. Why? I'm trying as hard as I can. But that very tryingness of me to get close to you, or you to get close to the other, we don't notice that what's causing that separation is not the lack of trying, but it's the grasping at self and other. So when we cultivate relationships and the quality of love that's not based on self-view, that's not based on that separation of self and other, then that same effort is not productive of suffering. That we can put the same kind of strength and commitment into generating love and caring for others, but it's not in order to sort of be close to the missing piece. We realize that the other, when we relate to to others through metta and karuna, that we become, or the other becomes a mirror that enables us to recognize our own wholeness. This is just the one way of talking about it. So one of the ways I like to describe this is so that when our relating with each other is based on the kind of peer quality, that sort of possessive love, this is what I call a relationship of separateness. And then when that love is based on metta, karuna, loving kindness, compassion, when it's not based on self-view, then this I would call a relationship of wholeness. And again, these are not sort of fixed statements, these are just themes to reflect on. But then what you find is that no matter how strong that love is, and how profound that caring is, then it doesn't produce suffering. Because it's not clouded by that illusion of separateness. There's a kind of boundlessness, a limitlessness, and a freedom within that. So that then when the one that we love is present, we delight in them. If they're not present, then nothing is missing. There's a kind of independence that we experience when we cultivate our ways of relating it in this manner. Well, maybe one last thing to put out, and I also want to leave a bit of time so that we can have some dialogue, and I'm sure some questions might arise, is that when we talk about loving kindness, then we can have a very sort of schmaltzy impression of that. Just the word loving kindness, we can feel a sort of a kind of cheesy quality to it. And I use I was talking about this a little while ago on our Thanksgiving retreat, and I used a phrase, something like the horror of Disney World comes to mind. We talk about, you know, metta sometimes, it's this sort of this kind of liking everything, like, you know, this sort of nightmarish, you know, everything is in pastel colors and with, you know, all these kind of fixed smiling plasticated faces that are everywhere, you know, the sort of Mickey Mouse, Minnie Mouse masks that are never stop smiling, whatever is happening, we're always smiling. And it's a sort of nightmarish quality. So sometimes we can relate to metta like that. We're supposed to sort of put a nice smile and hello, may all beings be happy. And you know, I am trying to be facetious. So. I'm trying to be dharmically facetious. So because metta does not mean liking it, trying to make ourselves like everything, because that which is painful or ugly or cruel, that is not likable for us. So we're not trying to just think pink and sugar everything over with metta. But more what metta, I would say, I find a helpful way of understanding it and working with it, is it's more a quality of radical acceptance. It's that place in the heart where everything belongs. Even the cruel and the ugly, the bitter, the violent. It's all just recognizing that it's all part of nature. That just because it exists, because it is that way, doesn't mean to say we have to approve of it or applaud it. We're not trying to applaud violence and cruelty and selfishness, etc. But we're saying this is part of nature. This is part of how things are. And so that then when we have metta, it's that accommodation, that spaciousness of heart. So it's not just the abundant, exalted, immeasurable radiance of light kind of spreading out into all regions, but it's actually the space that is abundant, exalted, immeasurable, that contains, you know, everything. And that that spaciousness of heart. And so then we're able to be with things, attributes of our own nature, attributes of others, attributes of the world, that are painful or bitter, as well as the beautiful and the delightful. And we can be with them in that with an openness of heart, without any hypocrisy. You're not trying to pretend that the bitter is actually sweet, or that the ugly is really delightful, or the cruel is quite okay in some way. I mean, we think it's sort of good, but there's a recognition of that fundamental belongingness. This is part of nature, and then wisdom then guides us into, well, if it's cool and harmful, then you know, don't follow it, or work to alleviate that. If it's noble and wholesome and beautiful, then you can, then wisdom tells us support that, rejoice in that, encourage that. So that with the encouragement to relate to each other with metta, it's a development of this radical acceptance, the spaciousness of heart, and that and letting go of the sense of self and other, just of loosening that self view, of sakkaya ditti, that concretization of me and you, and that in this mysterious way, the more that we love each other completely, with the more we're able to let go of each other, the more we are able to do that. Does that make sense? If you love someone, let go of them. So I offer these words for consideration this evening, and would like to open it up for a bit of dialogue, discussion. If there are any questions or things that people have to say. Yeah.
You said about having an attachment, and you said self. And if you from the level of self and other, mm-hmm. would you explain a little bit more what that means? What the connection is there?
Well, the feeling of I am this individual person, and this other thing. Belongs to me. That this is a separate other individual being out there, and that we are kind of basically independent from each other. And that I want to, I am trying to draw close or to be connected to this other. And so that the stronger that sense of me, of identification with the body, with the personality, with memories, ideas, characteristics, or the looking at the other as your child, or as your parent, or as your partner, or as your teacher, or whatever, the more that those roles are fixed, you are absolutely the mother, or absolutely the partner, or absolutely the student, and the other person is absolutely your child, or whatever. That we, the more those roles, those identities, the more that this is my body, I am this age, this is who I am, this is my story, my CV, this is what I am, the more concrete that is, then the more strong the separation will be. And it's not a matter of not honoring or recognizing those particular patterns, but there's a way that we can see, yeah, nature has these patterns, but yet it doesn't need to be a sense of I invested in that. That makes sense?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Would you say something about the idea of letting go of attachment as compared to becoming indifferent or hardened? Because it's real easy to think that I've gotten there, or someone thinks they've gotten there, when really they've shut down or hardened or whatever.
Yeah, it's tricky. The quality of reflection, like looking, examining for yourself what the affect is, or taking a look when the Buddha described the what's called the four bases of success, or how we succeed in doing anything. The four qualities are interest. You have to be interested in it. You have to apply effort, energy. You have to think about what it is that you're trying to do. And then the last one, which is the most crucial one, is you have to look at the results of what you've done. So it's a kind of reviewing. So that if you're, say, trying to apply that quality of non-attachment, then if you're busy sort of trying to do that and putting the effort and thinking it's a good thing, that's only three of the four. And the fourth one is, well, what's actually happening to me? You know, why are people giving me, are people giving me strange looks? You know, what are my relationships with others more harmonious? How do I hold others? How are others holding me? What's the result of this effort? What's happening here? And so that kind of exploring and examining can be, you know, the crucial piece. And a readiness to be honest. Because sometimes it is just more comfortable to shut down. You know, like and then, you know, you can label it as equanimity. But actually it's just, forget it. You know. And they can look very like each other. Also, one of the other things that I like to point out with when we're considering the three kind of three roots of suffering, greed, hatred, and delusion. Greed and hatred are pretty easy to see. They're sort of highlighted, right? Nice big pink highlighter. They're bright and clear, and you can see them distinctly. But delusion is hard to recognize because the very means whereby we would recognize it is muffled or muted or distorted. So that's where spiritual friendship comes in. So even if you can't be sure whether your own impressions are correct or are in tune with reality or not, check out what your friends think. You know, what are your, those who you trust who have some experience with spiritual practice, whose insight you respect, or your sense of that kind of unbiased viewpoint. Just to get the feedback from them, or see how you appear from the outside. That can be very helpful. Yeah.
What about the role of passion? Like in, we talked about in attachment love, we associate our passion with that kind of love. Seems like there's no passion in the other form of love. And so much of art and literature is about attachment love and makes an exciting read.
This is true. It's true, but yeah, it just depends. What the priorities are. You know, so it's true. You know, that the passion makes a good read, but also the you look at the state of some of the writers. Is that, yeah, it's a great read, you know, but would you, you know, and you can appreciate it, and I like to read, you know, good stuff as well as anybody else. You know, I appreciate that. But also, you know, I do look at the state of some of the writers, and realize this was, you know, Jack Kerouac was not a happy camper, even though he produced some great literature. You know, James Joyce was not an arahat. You know, and you know that. So that it's an interesting question, and I don't want to say that, you know, everything is, you know, unless it's got a sort of sterile purity, then it's not good. Because certainly finding that quality of aliveness that comes with you know, listening or dancing or reading, that's something that is that's coming from that place of purity. In a way, I mean, actually, you know, what James Joyce talked about in that respect was that, you know, a true work of art, when it's known, when it's witnessed, it produces an epiphany. And that's what meditation and spiritual training is really for. So one of the things I like to talk about in this respect is, like, why we enjoy that kind of passion, or why that says yes to us, you know, why we feel so good about that. It's like it takes us to a place of complete sort of focus and aliveness, and there's a sense of empathy with the universe in some way, some aspect of it. And that's what we love. We don't actually love the words or the sound or the movement or the shapes. It's the yes of the heart is the bit that we like. That's what that's the epiphany. And that's the brilliance of a work of art is that it's just a sound or a movement or a material form, a shape that can trigger that, can catalyze that kind of change within the person who sees it or hears it. And that's amazing and wonderful. But then what to me, and I was involved in arts and theatre and such like somewhat before I was a monk. The reason I think I got interested in spiritual training and the path of meditation was because you couldn't stay at that point of yes. You know, when the music really carried you, then, or you were kind of dancing in the moonlight, and you know, you can only hold it for so long, and then your legs give out. You know, or the DJ goes home, or the something wobbles, and so that was, you know, part of my kind of impetus in my own spiritual search was, how do I get to stay here? So it's really in that spirit. It's not negating that, but just saying, how can you do this properly? How can you make the party last? You know? In a way. So I'm basically a hedonist, actually. I'll come out as a I'm a pleasure seeker. That's why I'm a monk. I'm not kidding. Okay, maybe one last question.
So how long does the party last?
As long as you want. Well, it's time is an illusion. So it's this moment. This is it.
I'm a little bit at that point in my life where I'm beginning to wonder if I don't have to give up some of these things that I enjoy, that give me immense pleasure in the moment, so that I could concentrate more on my practice and have the hope of sort of having that pleasure for a longer term. It's delightful to talk to somebody who is a monk and who has Western ideas and is more willing to be open. What would you suggest?
Experiment. See what works.
Both work. So there is, if one knew for sure, then one would know, but I think it takes some amount of time. Mm-hmm. It's well worth investing that degree of time and experimenting to find out.
Sure.
Thank you.
Very good. Well, I see that the little clock here says 8:58, and I'm told that people start turning into pumpkins at 9. So we can close the evening. Is that suitable? So I wish you all well. Enjoy the festive season, the solstice in a day or two, and the return of the light shortly thereafter. And the monastery is just up 101. And everyone is welcome. So go well.